And let me thank you for the stimulating and good time that I've been enjoying these last few days. You've been very kind. Your feedback has been very helpful. I appreciate it. And I am glad that I came. I just wish you could put on a little warmer weather sometimes. To start this morning, let me review what we have tried to accomplish in these past 2 days. On Tuesday, I raised the question of what is or should be at the heart and soul of a Christian university, and tried to respond to that question with reflections on Colossians 1 and 2, in Christ are hidden all the treasures of wisdom and knowledge, and reflections on the prologue to John's Gospel, what he says about Christ, the divine Logos. And those themes developed yesterday as we explored the beginnings of Christian higher education in the Alexandrian Catechetical School and traced its influence in the educational thinking of St. Augustine and in the development of monastery schools and even the scholastic university. And you may recall we topped it off for dessert with some comments about John Calvin. What we saw is that there are four recurrent basic concerns of Christian higher education. One is the moral and spiritual formation of students. A second is the usefulness for service to church and society, the usefulness of liberal learning. A third is the unity of truth. That is to say, the relationship of truths of reason and truths of revelation. Ultimately, all truth is God's truth, the unity of truth. And the fourth, that examination of the works of God in creation opened to us the eternal wisdom of God. And so the fourth concern has been for a contemplative worship of God arising from the learning in which we engage. These four concerns, we traced them in various historical situations and noticed throughout the theological basis in that threefold logos theology. The divine Logos who orders his creation in intelligible ways, who gifts us with rational abilities so that we might understand and learn. Those together undergird that emphasis on the unity of truth, the contemplation of God, and the usefulness of learning. But then the Logos incarnate who redeems us from sin, this is what undergirds the concern for moral and spiritual formation. And so what we have is indeed a Christ-centered kind of education, if we are true to the heart and soul of the whole enterprise. Today, I want to raise a further question, which I'm sure has been in the backs of our minds during this time. What has all this to do with Christian higher education today? What has Alexandria to do with academia today? And what I want to say in response is that it should and still be the very soul of a Christian college or university, this Christological basis and these four central concerns. But today is different. This is not Hellenistic culture. We are no longer in medieval times. We live rather in a culture which still bears the marks of the Enlightenment and the reactions which the Enlightenment really asked for in postmodernism. So the question is, in effect, how does the pre-modern emphases, which we have seen, speak to the modern and postmodern? Because after all, modern and postmodern are not all there ever was. The pre-modern is what we have been looking at. How does that speak to Christian higher education today? Well, in order to get something of a handle on this, I want to focus on three problems which are well documented in the literature on contemporary higher education. The first, familiar to us all, I'm sure, a pervasive secularization. I'm thinking, of course, of George Marsden's book, The Soul of the American University, from which I parodied the title of these lectures, The Soul of a Christian University. What Marsden does there, and in an earlier work of his called The Secularization of the Academy, is to trace the process whereby what began as a Christian educational institution in case after case became secularized through the influence of the Enlightenment. The same sort of thing has been documented with regards to Princeton by my colleague Mark Knoll in Church History. And again, with regards to Harvard, by yet another writer. It's a story which in American religious history is being documented repeatedly these days. This was the effect of the Enlightenment. The Enlightenment with its concern for reason alone, for objective reason, independently of input from tradition, from past authorities, or indeed from revelation. So reason alone, objectively, without presuppositions, preconceptions. And you find that in the history of ideas that fed into the Enlightenment. Some of you in conversation have talked of Descartes and his influence. You remember when he entered that stove-heated room and bracketed every belief and conviction that he had in order to start ex nihilo in constructing what he could know for sure. William Temple, the former Archbishop of Canterbury, calls that the darkest moment in the history of Europe. I'm inclined to think that the influence is at least as great from Francis Bacon, a contemporary of Descartes, on the English scene. Francis Bacon, who introduced inductive methods for empirical research and in the process turned his back on what he called the idols that people were bowing down to. That is to say, the preconceptions embedded in language, the preconceptions of the philosophical traditions that had been inherited, and so on and so forth. Turning his back on these idols, objective empirical research alone, you see. Or John Locke, you remember his theory of sense experience, that the mind comes to this world like a tabula rasa, a blank sheet of paper, nothing on it at all to condition to select what is observed, let alone to put it in an intelligible context. Or perhaps you remember Kant, Immanuel Kant, and his title, Religion Within the Limits of Reason Alone. And then you have it coming to even fuller expression in 19th century positivism, the insistence that every kind of knowledge we have must be derived from objective empirical data by the methods of science. You see, the Enlightenment's light was purportedly the light of reason. But the light of reason was the light of science, of objective empirical scientific methods. So that the Enlightenment confined us to that kind of mentality, an objective mentality, stripped of religious commitments, stripped of a tradition that is inherited with insight into the truth, stripped of reference to any authorities other than the authority of empirical data. Well, you see, what ruled then was in effect the loss of that Alexandrian tradition that we've been thinking about. A loss of the Christian conviction that faith leads to understanding, you see. What was lost in the Enlightenment was the relationship between faith and reason that had enabled Christian scholarship, Christian education, Christian learning to grow, to thrive for centuries. Now that was repudiated in the name of the rule of reason alone. And so the secularization of the university proceeded step by step uninhibited. Some Christian institutions, originally Christian institutions, Harvard, for instance, Princeton, for instance, became, in effect, secular institutions. I did graduate work at Northwestern University, founded by the Methodists. The motto of the university was a biblical text. A university today completely secularized. But in those which remain Christian institutions today, the secularization process has continued to operate. There is a recent book by Douglas Sloan called Faith and Knowledge, in which he argues that in mainline church-related colleges in America, there prevails a two-realm theory of truth, a dualism. On the one hand, there is the learning that goes on in the classroom, objective Enlightenment style, detached from any religious moorings. And on the other hand, there is the affirmation of the truth of the Christian faith in a compartment by itself. Compartmentalized two realms of truth. Now, how shall we then respond to that sort of thing? How can Alexandria, pre-modern, speak to secularization today? Well, I think you can see how the tradition that we've been exploring does speak. First of all, we need to reaffirm what I'm going to call the perspectival nature of all human knowing, you see. This is something which the postmodern has recognized, that we do not think in a vacuum. We're not dehumanized, calculating machines. We are personal beings with a history, culturally located, so that all thinking seems to be thinking in the light of, thinking from a perspective, historically, culturally situated. Now, obviously, that's not the whole story, because all of us are generically human. So there is always some universal psychological process going on. The order of creation by the divine logos includes the ordering of the human mind. But we still are historical, cultural beings, and our thinking, knowing, is perspectival. But of particular concern for us is that we're not only historically situated, we are religiously situated. Christianly or unchristianly situated. And Christian thought, Christian learning, is learning with perspective, thought from a perspective. Like Martin Luther, we tend to say, "Here I stand, I can do no other." And so it is this perspectival nature of knowing, the realization that faith seeks understanding. As Augustine said, faith is understanding's step, and understanding is faith's reward. The two cannot be torn apart. So we cannot settle for either an anti-intellectual withdrawal from the world of ideas, or for a dualistic theory of truth. So the first thing we say in response, then, is to reaffirm this perspectival nature of all human knowing. And secondly, we need to reaffirm the unity of truth in response to the dualistic view of truth, which so often prevails. We need to talk seriously about the integration of faith and learning. We must do it in ways that respect the integrity of the discipline, without treating the discipline as if it is immune from the influence and input of other disciplines, theology included. After all, the unity of truth speaks of interdisciplinary integration. And the thing the Christian is concerned about, and the Christian university should be concerned about, is that theology plays its role within the integration of disciplines. The integration, therefore, of faith and learning. That interdisciplinary dialogue must include theology if we are serious about the unity of truth. Richard Newhouse, the editor of the magazine First Things, in an article that appeared in January 96 called The Christian University 11 Theses, speaks to this kind of issue. Let me read from three of his theses. It is within the Christian understanding of reality that everything finds its role. Nothing that is true or good or beautiful can be excluded. The work of a Christian university in service to the fullness of truth is to anticipate the promise described by St. Paul as God's plan for the fullness of time, to unite all things in Him, things in heaven and things on earth. A Christian university rejects the dichotomies that pit truth against truth. There is an unrecognizable alliance between anti-intellectuals outside the university and intellectuals within the university when they propose an antithesis between faith and reason, heart and mind, a divorce between fact and value, belief and knowledge, piety and learning. A Christian university has as its premise the knowledge that all truth is one, and all ways to truth are one because the author and end of all truth is one. A Christian university, then, will settle for nothing less than a comprehensive account of reality. Not content with the what of things, it wrestles with the why of things. Not content with knowing how, it asks what for. It cannot evade the hard questions. And therefore, theology and philosophy, the sciences of meaning, are at the very heart of the Christian university. That is Richard Neuhaus. So then, the first problem we face is the effect of pervasive secularization. The second problem is a utilitarian view of knowledge and education, pervasive in pragmatic America. Even so-called liberal arts colleges are often dominated by vocationally oriented training programs rather than liberal learning as such. And the same is true in American Christianity, in evangelicalism, indeed, because of the pragmatic bent of Christians who realize there is so much that needs doing by way of service to God and the church. And so this feeds our utilitarian approaches to learning. But the impact of that utilitarianism is very evident when you think of a book that some of you have raised in discussion, Mark Knowles' The Scandal of the Evangelical Mind. You see? Why so scandalously little mind among evangelicals? Well, in part, you say, because of anti-intellectualism, yes, but an anti-intellectualism that is fed by a utilitarian view of knowing. You see? Or David Wells' No Place for Truth, a similar story. Why do students come to college? What was on your mind when you went to college? And we begin to see how pervasive this is. Now let's probe a little bit further. It seems to me that this utilitarian view of knowledge has taken the place of the contemplative view of knowledge, which we have begun to see in the Alexandrian tradition. The contemplation of eternal truths, of God's purposes and the order which God has ordained in his creation, the contemplation of eternal truth becomes the contemplation of the wisdom of God, contemplation of the goodness of God, contemplation of the power of God. And in the medieval university, this contemplation became an overt act of worship. Historians call it the doxological theme in education. Study, an exercise of worship. The doxological theme, the loss of the contemplative. I trace this back again to Francis Bacon. In 1605, in his Instauration of Learning, he was writing about the need that he saw for educational reform in the universities. He was critical, in ways typical of his day, critical of the scholastic university. Because its debates were unrelated to life. And he added that the scholastic university ignored the creation itself in its examination of philosophies about the creation and theology about the Creator, but fail to look at the creation itself. So what Francis Bacon did in that 1605 work was to say we need to change the relationship between contemplation and action. 15 years later, in 1620, in his Novum Organum, he explained how. We need to focus study on an inductive examination of nature's processes. And he introduced his famous inductive methods. The inductive study of nature's processes will enable us to understand cause-effect sequences so that we can control nature. We can exercise our control over nature. And like a good Reformed Christian, he cited the creation mandate to replenish, subdue, have dominion. But, he added, we must control it not for our own advantage, not to increase our national power, and that in the age of Elizabeth and James I was really something. Not to increase our national power, but we must control it in order, as far as we can, to remedy the effects of the fall, to improve the human condition. So, educational reform for that purpose sounds good. But what happened to contemplation? Oh, he's very plain. Religious contemplation tells us that we should seek to remedy the human condition. In other words, all that religious contemplation does is to tell you what you ought to do, the purpose. And so what you have is an objective, scientific type education, detached of any religious contemplation in itself. No intrinsic relationship between faith and learning, only the extrinsic relationship of purpose. You see. And so the loss of the contemplative life, and with it the loss for the unity of truth. Because only the usefulness of liberal learning survives. Oh, he was concerned for the moral formation of students. So he held only to two of the four purposes which had involved Christian higher education all this time. And you know the story, that scientific research is seeking for new knowledge to shape the future, not for a heritage of truth that we draw from the past. So the whole focus is changed. The basic purpose of liberal learning, to transmit a heritage from the past, to shape values through the heritage of values transmitted from the past. And the research led to scientific specialization. Specialization leads to the fragmentation of learning and the unity of truth lost, moreover. The result is that today you don't know the difference between liberal education and general education. I see college catalogues and meet people in colleges who use the two terms as equivalents. If they have a list of general education requirements, they say this is a liberal education. Oh, far from it. You see, general education is simply a potpourri of different things to guard against narrowness. Liberal education is a heritage of truth and values transmitted from the past. Well, today's disputes over the canon of great literature reflect precisely that ambiguity. You see? We want now not to be narrow, but to be broad enough to include different perspectives. Different perspectives to provide for deprovincialization. And the result is that the teaching of literature is no longer the transmission of values, it's an exercise in political power. You see. The utilitarian view of education. How does Alexandria speak to this utilitarian view of learning? Well, first, we must reaffirm the usefulness of liberal learning, not reject its utility. Reaffirm its usefulness, but without reducing education just to a utilitarian activity. I think of what John Milton says in his classic essay on education. Milton, who represents the Puritan colleges that grew out of the Protestant Reformation, says he, "I call a complete and generous education that which fits a man to perform justly, skillfully, and magnanimously all the offices, both private and public, of peace and war." What he's talking about is not specific vocational training programs. What he's talking about is the rich heritage of understandings, the skills, the thinking skills, communication skills, writing skills that are transferable to a myriad of activities throughout a changing lifetime of career shifts. You see, the usefulness of liberal learning. So don't settle for a narrow utility of immediacy and cash value. There is a larger usefulness in preparing people to contribute constructively to the life of the church, to culture. A value in personal moral growth, in shaping the mind, and in seeing the unity of truth which praises the Creator. So we need again to reaffirm a theocentric, Christocentric, logos-centered unity of truth and make Christ-centered education a reality. The third problem that I see today is equally obvious. The moral climate on campuses. The lack of student moral and faith development in an age of moral anarchy. This is not unrelated to what has gone before. Mark Schwain, who used to teach at University of Chicago and left to go to a Lutheran church-related college, Valparaiso, knows what he's talking about. In his book, significantly entitled Exiles from Eden, he talks about changes in the nature of the academic task that has been narrowed down to research, to the neglect of teaching and student formation. You see? Exiles from the Eden that was concerned for moral and spiritual formation. And a recent book by Willimon and Naylor at Duke University, Willimon is the university chaplain, is entitled The Abandoned Generation. It's talking about students with their moral groundlessness, having no sense of why something is right or wrong, having no world view to ground an ethic, with therefore the outlandish things which result. Or perhaps you remember Alan Bloom's book, The Closing of the American Mind, in which after teaching at Cornell and Chicago for years, he complained that students today talk as if there is no such thing as right or wrong, no such thing as truth or falsity. It says they have no self-image, no understanding of what it is to be a person, and they have no worldview to ground any such notions. You see. Well, this kind of description, this arisen. Let me suggest that one reason is Enlightenment individualism. You see, the Enlightenment was not just characterized by this excessive claim about objectivity. It was characterized as well by the enthroning of the liberty of the individual. Reinhold Niebuhr, in his Nature and Destiny of Man, traces the progressive emphasis on individual freedom from the Renaissance political thinkers on through the 18th century, more revolutionary thinkers, on through the development of Romanticism in the 19th century, to the absolute freedom, the dreadful freedom of Jean-Paul Sartre. You see. The 18th century was marked by an emphasis on individualism. I call it the Robinson Crusoe theory. Each individual alone on an island with his goats and his God. Oh, Daniel Defoe knew what he was doing. He was a social philosopher. And Robinson Crusoe was a philosophical novel. You see. Oh, you know the story. He was able to rule nature. And when Manfredi came and wasn't yet a rational being, he had to subdue him and hold him under until he became a rational being. Then they entered into a kind of social contract. And the Spanish sailors, when they came, they weren't to be trusted. They weren't rational beings. But when the English sailors came, of course, they were rational, so they entered into a social contract and sailed back to England. But see, the crux is the individual liberty, able to master one's own self, one's own life, one's own world, completely free. And how this is echoed today. We create our own value. We create our own meanings, you see, as if we live in a chaotic world and we give it shape and order. What happened to the Logos doctrine? You see, the orderer of creation, the orderer of our lives. That individualism. Well, obviously, in response to that individualism, the Alexandrian tradition says, build moral community. Draw on a heritage of values. Make sure that the educational process includes the paedagogos, that mentor-guide relationship. And so says Mark Twain. What he advocates and what he has done at Valparaiso is to develop a religiously oriented community of learning. They call it Jesus College, rather appropriately. You'll see. And what Willimon and Naylor recommend, as they write from Duke, is the development of small, value-oriented communities on campus. And David Holcomer has written a book about the in loco parentis, principle and its disappearance, and says that what we need instead is the development of communities on campus. And some of you have made reference to Stanley Hauerwas, who reminds us that values are transmitted, character is shaped, faith develops through entering into the life of a community and making its story your own. And Parker Palmer talks of the teacher who provides space in teaching for students to grow as persons, to develop as moral beings. And just last week I heard a lecture in which somebody was saying that feminist ethicists have recently been reminding us of our interdependency as human beings. After all, the things that women of all people know is the dependency of the one they carry within their belly. You see? And nurture. The interdependent relationship exhibited in that model community of the family. We need to develop community to overcome the excesses of individualism. But there is a growing relativism, of course, and this is part of the postmodern picture. Part of the postmodern picture. So that when Bloom says they talk as if there is no such thing as right or wrong, no such thing as truth in moral matters or anything else, this is an echo of the extreme postmodernism. And again, the Alexandrian tradition speaks to this. We need to stress, reaffirm the objectivity of truth. Yes, it's objectivity. The locus of truth is in God's knowledge, not ours, not in our propositions. The locus of truth is in God's mind. That, in part, is why our knowledge is perspectival. Because what we know of God's truth, we know as human beings. And human knowledge is always finite, because humans are finite. Human knowledge is always fallible, because humans are fallible. Human knowledge is always perspectival, because we're not omniscient. You see. But truth is objective. God's knowledge, that's the locus of truth. And it seems to me that in this day of moral anarchy, we need to re-examine teaching objectives and teaching methods. You remember the story of Abelard that I mentioned yesterday? Who, in teaching theology, wanted to do it by having public debates in which students would engage, sic et non, pro and con, on every point. Wonderful device for teaching people to think. But if the aim of education is also moral formation, then we have to aim through the thinking process to what is our goal beyond. Years ago, when I was quite young, we had a department evaluation with outside evaluators. And when this senior person in the profession finally sat in my office to tell me what he had observed, he said to me, "What sort of student do you want to come out of this department?" I never thought of that. I'd thought a lot about what kind of student I wanted to get into the department. But what kind of a student do you want to go out? The department. I never forgot that question. It changed my teaching. You see? Because as a teacher, I'm a shaper of people. And that is an awesome responsibility. So I say again, community, the paideia tradition of transmitting a heritage from the past. And let's have some paedagogoi, mentors, guides, taking personal interest in the moral and spiritual development of students. And remember that Jesus Christ, the Logos incarnate who redeems us, is the Creator who ordered this world, ordered our lives and our minds so that we might know the truth, and knowing the truth, we might worship its source, God Almighty. Thank you.